The next case on calendar for argument is Linhart versus New York Life Insurance. Good morning, counsel.
Good morning, your honors. May it please the court, Christopher Petun on behalf of plaintiff appellant Barbara Linhart. And with me at counsel table is my colleague, David Clavatt. And with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Please be reminded that the time shown on the clock is your total time remaining.
Thank you, your honor. The central issue in this appeal is whether a life insurer must follow each of the procedural safeguards required by California Insurance Code sections 10113.71 and 72 before terminating a pre-2013 life insurance policy for non-payment of premium. If the answer is yes, that an insurer must follow each of these procedural safeguards created by these statutes, then summary judgment must be reversed when an insurer fails either to provide a form to designate a third party to receive notice of pending lapse or notify the policy owner of their right to change their designation or designate one or more persons.
Okay, counsel, which, if any, of these are you asserting was not followed by the insurer?
Both, Your Honor. Our primary argument is that that the insurer, New York Life in this case, failed to provide the form to Mr. Linhart entirely.
Okay, so that's a little bit of a tricky question in my view, because when he first got the policy, that requirement was not in place.
Would you agree? Right.
And so you're saying that retroactively they had to send him the form even though the policy was already in effect?
Well, I'm uncomfortable with the word retroactively, because if you look at the McHugh opinion, mm-hmm. the whole first portion of the opinion discusses the nature of the retroactivity of these statutes.
Right.
And says these statutes aren't retroactive. Rather, they add guardrails to life insurance policies, irrespective of whether or not they were issued or delivered before January 1st, 2013, mm-hmm. or after January 1st, 2013. So the question perhaps that you're driving towards is, well, if he got the policy in this case in 2007, when can the insurer comply with subsection 72A and provide him with a form? And my answer to that would be on January 1st, 2013, when the statutes went into effect and that requirement now existed.
I thought that requirement was when the insurance was initiated, when the policy was first bought. That requirement, right?
That's correct. For policies that were purchased issued or delivered starting on January 1st, 2013.
Mm-hmm.
The way McHugh looked at this issue.
How is the statute worded?
The exact language, as I recall, uses the term a life insurance policy shall not be issued or delivered until an applicant has had a chance to, until an applicant has been provided with a form to make a designation of a third party to receive notice of pending lapse or termination.
But if the policy has already been issued, how can you comply with that statute?
Well, that's what I was suggesting a moment ago about the moment that the statutes go into effect on January 1st, 2013, you provide the form, and then you've complied. And you're
how have you complied? Because, again, the statute says the policy shall not be issued unless you provide a designation form. Well, but here, as of January 2013, it already was issued 6 years ago.
Sure. And Judge Chung, I'm glad you brought this up, because the issue about how you interpret the statute, if you look at subsection 72A in isolation and just say, okay, it has this term, the applicant, and it speaks to, you know, shall be issued or delivered, then in isolation, it seems that this is only a prospective statute. But what McHugh counsels and what McHugh actually did in its analysis was it pointed out this very issue. It says, if you look at subsection 72A by itself, it seems to only apply prospectively to applicants. However,
it doesn't say it seems. It actually says it unmistakably applies only to new policies.
Sure. But what McHugh also did was it continued its analysis and said, we must consider these statutes as a package. And so the analysis of the meaning of subsection 72A doesn't end with the language of subsection 72A. Rather, on page 236 of the McHugh opinion, it says we start with the language of the statute. And there, what the California Supreme Court did was begin a parsing exercise. It started with subsection 72A and used the language that you just pointed out. And then it moves on to subsection 72B and says, okay, does subsection 72B inform the meaning of subsection 72A and vice versa? And there, subsection 72B discusses the right of a policy owner, which I recognize is different in the context of the language of the statute, to receive annual notice of their right to designate a third party.
Was that done in this case?
I'm sorry?
Was that done in this case? Was there annual notice of a right for designation done in this case from the time the statute was amended?
New York Life provided a notice. And part of what we contend here, and part of the reason we believe summary judgment should be reversed, was that the notice that was provided was inadequate because it didn't follow all of the requirements of the statute, of subsection 72B.
I know that you had raised both issues before the district court.
Correct.
But I only see in your opening brief reference to the argument about 72A. It doesn't seem, am I missing something? Is there a part of your opening brief that resuscitates or brings up a challenge to the district court's addressing the 72B issue?
No, it's not in the opening brief.
Well, then why isn't it waived?
No, well, because once the issue became crystallized, it was brought up as part of our briefing with regards to certification to the California State Supreme Court, and it was brought up in the reply brief.
But it's not a part of your appellate challenge. When you filed your opening brief, you were specifically addressing the district court's resolution of the 72A issue. I took it to mean that you had abandoned the other issue because there had been some type of notice done on an annual basis, even if it was not a designation form.
Well, I mean, our view was that we didn't waive it because it was ultimately brought up in the briefing and it remains part of the record.
But you know that, I mean, our case law is pretty consistent that if you don't mention something in the opening brief, we can deem it forfeited.
Sure.
Okay.
I understand.
I mean, back to my colleague's question, I take your point, and you know, we've all read McHugh very carefully, that we're supposed to read the statutory system together in context and it works together. And all that is true, but it just happens to be the case that 72A talks about applicants and new policies. So even if all of these provisions are in force on day one from when the law passes, how does it apply to Mr. Linhart when he was not an applicant and there was already an existing policy?
Well, part of our briefing, we did make the point that our view is that even if that Mr. Linhart always was the applicant, irrespective of whether or not the policy is issued or not, he has the rights. If for whatever reason the policy lapsed for any other reason, he would very well have had to entered into an application.
But it's, in essence, you're almost kind of asking us to rewrite the statute and take policy owner and supplant it with applicant, even though the California Supreme Court drew that distinction, as you were saying, in reading A and B, and noted that distinction in saying that is why subsection A, you know, unquestionably applies to new policies, unmistakably applies to only new policies.
Right. But that portion is in the section of McHugh where what the California Supreme Court was doing the linguistic parsing of both the side of McHugh's counsel and Protective Life's counsel. The actual holding comes later in the opinion, which is on page 240, and the conclusion that they draw is new and existing policy owners must have the opportunity to designate additional people to receive notice of termination, and cites both subsections 72A and B in support of that contention.
No, and that's true, but that doesn't mean that the insurance company is obligated to send a designation form to existing policy owners, right? That is an obligation that resides in subsection A, even as subsection B requires new and old to get an annual right to designate third parties.
But if the insurance companies weren't required to send designation forms to prior policy owners, what that would do is it would create two notice schemes whereby certain policy owners who purchased their life insurance policies on or after January 1st, 2013, have one set of rights, which includes the right to receive a designation form, and those who purchased their life insurance policies prior to January 1st, 2013. And they would have a lesser set of rights because they would not be entitled to receive that designation form. And that's not what McHugh counsels us here, because specifically in the second portion, that starts on page 240 of McHugh, in addition to the language saying that both sections, subsections apply, it looks at the legislative history and specifically highlights the fact that the protections that were intended in these statutes were for existing policy owners. It doesn't make a distinction and say that these protections were for new policy owners only, or this particular subsection's protections were for new policy owners.
But counsel, it makes a distinction between applicants and policyholders, and that's the difficulty I'm having with your argument, is that you are ignoring the fact that A talks about applicants, and as my colleague said, you're trying to import the definition of policyholder into A to make A retroactively applicable to applicants.
Well, and I recognize that difficulty that you're having, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. It's a fair one. And the district court took a similar approach, a very strict textual analysis of what subsection 72A says. It uses the term applicant, mm-hmm. and my understanding of it is that is different from policy owner. Mm-hmm. That's it. Mm-hmm. But the rules or the canons of California statutory construction say that you have to consider something much broader than just the isolated text. You got to consider the whole
package. Well, I don't know about that. If the meaning of the statute is clear from the text, you don't go to statutory interpretation. You don't go to canons of interpretation. And I don't see how the meaning of this language is unclear in any way.
I hear your point on that. But if that were the case here, then in McHugh, they would not have gone to the second point of their analysis where they actually spent time looking at the legislative history. If the language was clear, according to the California Supreme Court, they would have been done when they did the linguistic parsing because they didn't need to go any further. But the court recognized—
The court needed to discuss the other provisions, other sub-provisions of point 71 and point 72, right? And so for those other provisions, other than the sub-provision A, the court said, well, for those provisions, it would apply to even pre-existing policies because there's an ongoing obligation to provide notice. But A specifically, the court says otherwise. So that's how I make sense of the language, which could otherwise appear to be ambiguous in McHugh.
I understand that. But but one of the things that's really important to note is that that what the California Supreme Court is saying is that each of these sections actually inform the meaning of what the others are, taking the words not in isolation but as a whole. And that's the exercise that the district court should have done. And I would urge that if there's any doubt that this is a state law issue and that the California Supreme Court should be allowed to speak to the meaning directly on subsection 72A.
All right, thank you, counsel. You've exceeded your time. We'll give you a minute or two for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Rawlinson, and may it please the court. My name is Caleb Walenek, and I represent New York Life Insurance and Annuity Corporation. As the panel's noted, the only statutory question before this court, it's raised in the opening brief, is whether Section 10113.72 Subdivision A required NYLIAC to send a designation form to Mr. Linhart in addition to the 9 annual notices about the right to designate that it did send him. And the plain text of the statute and the California Supreme Court's opinion in McHugh both show that the answer is no. And that's true both because of what the statutes in McHugh say and what they don't say. On page 236 of the McHugh opinion, the Supreme Court wrote that 72A unmistakably and clearly applies only to new policies. That was a definitive statement reflecting reasoned analysis. And in fact, Judge Tung, as you mentioned, I think 72A, because it's so clear, that's what made McHugh a difficult case. Is you had other provisions that seemed to point in the opposite direction, but 72A is clear, and the Supreme Court had to go to great lengths to grapple with that text. But nothing in McHugh shows any attempt to disregard that plain text. And when this court read the same statutory language in Sinnoh on page 948 of that opinion, this court straightforwardly observed that everyone has the right to designate, but the requirement to send a designation form applies at a particular moment in time, and that's upon the initiation of a new policy. And that's because 72A uses the word applicant. It never refers to a policy owner, and the usual meaning of the term applicant is someone who is applying for coverage but has not yet obtained it. It's a transitory term that only is true while certain conditions are true, similar to words like nominee or candidate or fiancé. You wouldn't say that designation carries throughout the rest of your life because it used to be true. And so once an applicant has obtained a policy, they are no longer an applicant, they are a policy owner. And the statutes use the words in that way. And this court, as the Supreme Court did in McHugh, should give those terms different meanings.
Now, counsel, how would this work in practice if the annual notices are given and then the person, the policyholder, responds to that notice by requesting of the insurer for a designation form, and then the insurer then gives the designation form?
Absolutely. And we have a sworn testimony from our 30B6 opponent and then in a declaration that we had forms available at all relevant times, that if you called and asked for a form, we would send you one, that we did, in fact, send forms to people who did not have a form on their application because they had purchased their policy years before. Mr. Linhart received 9 annual notices or sent 9 annual notices of the right to designate. He simply did not exercise that right. And there is no challenge at this point to the sufficiency of those annual notices. That's been forfeited. And the district court's reasons on page 17 and 18 of the excerpts of record as to why those annual notices were sufficient is correct. Challenges to the typeface and the phrasing, they don't bear out under the rest of California law. But nothing in the way that the annual form, or so the annual notices interact with the forms, compromises the statutory's purposes here. Everyone has the right to designate. Everyone gets annual notice. Simply whether a form is sent unsolicited to an existing policy owner, or whether they're given notice of the right, and then they can call and ask questions, and it can be tailored to their particular circumstances. Mr. Linhart called multiple times to ask about other things. He had no problem doing so based on the record. He could have easily asked about his right to designate, and we would have sent him a form. We had them available. But 72A, which is the only statutory provision at issue, does not require sending a form to a policy owner. In one sense, it doesn't even regulate policies at all, because it is speaking to a pre-issuance timeframe before the policy is issued. That's true based on the word applicant. It's also true based on the timing language in 72A about shall not be issued or delivered until. The policy here was issued in 2007. That's an undisputed fact on page 337 of the record. That's when the policy was issued. And so if NYLIAC had to send a form to Mr. Linhart under the plain language of 72A, it would have had to be in 2007. But McHugh makes very clear throughout the opinion that these statutes are not retroactive.
Counsel, on that, I mean, I know just a moment ago we were pretty hard on your friend on the other side regarding McHugh, but I think the reason why we are here is because there is some ambiguity in the McHugh opinion, because later on, after the court talks about subprovision A, it then goes on to say these sections are nonetheless best read to extend protections to policies issued before these sections went into effect. So why doesn't that more general language encompass A as well and support your opposing counsel's argument?
So a couple of things. One, when the Supreme Court talked about the right to designate on page 240 of that opinion, it speaks generally. It does reference both 72A and B, and I think that's there's a good reason for that. But it speaks generally about the right to designate, and we agree that everyone has the right to designate. What McHugh does not say is that you have to provide a form to someone who is not an applicant. And I think the reason that the Supreme Court references 72A and B on page 240 is that 72A does two things, the first of which is very subtle, is that it introduces the concept of the right to designate. It talks about that you can have someone to receive notice. 72B then refers to that in shorthand. It doesn't restate all the things that a recipient would do. That doesn't mean that 72B requires a form. 72B says nothing about a form. It requires annual notice, as the Supreme Court noted in footnote 7 of its opinion, that 72A and B have meaningfully distinct language. And so 72A kind of introduces this concept about a secondary designee. It then talks about providing a form to an applicant, which is not the situation we have here. 72B then picks up that concept and says that everyone has the right to designate and that everyone receives annual notice. And so there's no inconsistency with the overall holding of McHugh that says that everyone has the right, the statutes apply without respect to when the policies were issued. But what that doesn't mean is that a particular pre-issuance requirement about providing a form to an applicant also applies post-issuance, because as you noted earlier, even if we had provided a form on January 1st, 2013, that still wouldn't have satisfied the text of the statute. The policy had already been issued. And I don't read anything in the McHugh opinion as saying that the plain text of the statute goes away, that what is unmistakable and clear is somehow disregarded because other parts of the statute were less clear and the Supreme Court was trying to trying to take them as a whole, as we agree that they should do. But that doesn't mean that the plain text of 72A and its very specific language about applicants, that doesn't apply to existing policy owners. And the parties in McHugh actually agreed about this. The Court of Appeal noted in its 2019 decision that went up on appeal that the plaintiffs had actually conceded that Mr. McHugh was not an applicant in 2013. There was no dispute among the parties that 72A did not require sending a form to Mr. McHugh in that case. And so this wasn't a situation, to go back to the discussion of the text, this is not a situation where the Supreme Court was giving multiple competing alternatives about what 72A might mean. It did not give any counterarguments. It put out the discussion of 72A in a separate paragraph that's 140 plus words long. It then has footnote 7 that's nearly 100 words long. Doesn't include any counterarguments, no hedging language, doesn't try to distance itself from the Court of Appeals statement that these statutes don't require sending a form to an existing policy owner. And nothing in the rest of the McHugh opinion gets rid of that textual analysis. McHugh starts off with the statutory text. It notes that the court would first consider the words of the statutes as it's generally the most reliable indicator of the legislature's intended purpose. And so the text of the statutes here don't show any intent to give a form to a policy owner. I think there's a good reason for that as well. Now, it's not the legislative history does not speak clearly on this issue, but when you're applying for a policy, you're already filling out a lot of paperwork, and putting one more box on that piece of paper to fill out or not, it's a sensible thing. But once you're a policy owner, there are a lot of notices that have to be provided, or might need to be made available. Affirmatively sending out form after form after form, year after year after year, can be overwhelming. It can create a dilution of the most important notices. And so the legislature was more focused on the right to designate, not about the particular mechanism for exercising that right, whether you receive a form unsolicited or whether you get a notice and you can call and ask about it. The legislature left that to insurers to figure out the best way to provide this notice, to determine whether and how they wanted their forms to look, or whether they wanted to provide notice and say, you can call us and we can talk about it, because maybe you already designated someone years ago and you're perfectly happy with that designee, or maybe you want to change it, or maybe you want to add someone. We can work through that on the phone, as opposed to just sending out a form unsolicited. And it's different. It looks different when you're an applicant.
Counsel, I have a question that gets into a bit of the intricacies of insurance law. So when is a policy issued? If it's, for example, up for renewal, about to expire, does it need to be reissued again? Are there policy periods that are limited in duration? And
so it does depend on the type of insurance. So, you know, in homeowner's insurance or auto insurance, you might have a 6-month or a year period, and then it might renew. You might keep the same policy number but have a new contract, and at that point, either party can opt out. The insurance company can decide not to renew. You can decide to go get a different policy. Life insurance works differently. These are long-term policies. And in particular, this policy is a universal life policy. I believe it could last up to age 121. There are tax regulations on how long these policies can last. But it's designed to last for the lifetime of the insured. So it was issued once. Page 337 of the record, paragraph 2. Says this policy was issued in 2007. It was not renewed at any point. Plaintiffs have not argued that it renewed. Our 30B6 witness testified that renewal is not a concept that we use in this space. And so this policy is from 2007. And I know the Pitt case talked about renewal in kind of extraterritoriality context when it certified a question to the California Supreme Court. But there, to the extent the court was thinking about renewal, the obligations were coming after the purported renewal. Here, the statutes speak to before issuance. So regardless of whether this policy is issued or delivered, or whether the renewal concept matters, 72A clearly speaks to a time before the policy is issued, when someone is still an applicant before they become a policyholder. On certification, very briefly, because this is not a genuinely open question, McHugh speaks with one voice. The statutes are clear. Ordinary principles of statutory interpretation are sufficient to resolve this case. There's no need to certify and trouble the California Supreme Court with this question. But even if there were more uncertainty, this court is perfectly competent to apply California law. This is not an important question in the sense that this court would normally consider in a certification context. It's certainly important to this case, but it's not going to have ripple effects throughout other areas of insurance law. We don't disagree that everyone has the right to designate, that everyone receives annual notice. It's just about whether NILIAP was required to affirmatively send a form unsolicited or whether it could provide notice and then get a call back and work through it at that point. This is a shrinking number of cases as time goes on and as claims are paid. This is not going to have continuing effects for other areas. And it would take 2-3 years potentially for the California Supreme Court to reach this issue, and it might not actually reach it at the end of that 2 or 3 year wait. So plaintiff chose federal court. She'd wait until the end of merits briefing to raise the possibility of certification to the California Supreme Court. I don't think it's warranted here. And if plaintiff had raised class certification at the end of her brief, we also raised it. If this court affirms on the merits, there's no need to reach class certification. If the court were interested in that, Small and Farley very clearly resolve the issues in NILIAC's favor. They make it impossible for plaintiff to satisfy typicality, predominance, superiority. And even though the district court didn't explain its, didn't give more reasons for denying class certification, in Hannon versus Data Products, cited in the brief, page 508, this court noted that the district court there had denied class certification without any explanation and without making any findings. This court nevertheless affirmed the denial of class certification on typicality grounds. And this court should do the same here. Unless there are any further questions, this court should affirm.
All right, thank you, counsel. Have a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. And for the extra time, I'll try to be very, very brief. Judge Sanchez, you had raised the question about waiver of the argument on the appropriateness of the notice, and I was corrected while sitting down that in footnote 4 of our opening brief, we do make reference to the inadequacy of the notice and raise that as an issue.
Usually arguments in a footnote aren't enough to preserve the argument.
Well, the we provide a citation to the actual notices themselves so that the court could have an examination of what those what the notices actually provided in terms of the language and make a determination on whether or not, as a matter of law, it could see that the notice gave that these annual notices were appropriate according to the terms of the statute.
Yeah, I'm looking at footnote 4 now. It's one sentence. It says the district court compounded its error by reading out of the statutes the notice requirement that the policy owner be given the right to change their designation, which implies they were given the right to designate in the first place. It doesn't even cite subdivision B. So,
going up to as I recall, let's see here. I mean, you're right. It doesn't explicitly point to subsection 72B. However, the footnote for the paragraph to which it's referring to is a discussion on the appropriateness of the on the meaning of the statutes as a whole, which is consistent with our point that they need to be taken as a package. One thing I'd like to just point out about subsection 72C, which is part of the briefing, subsection 72C does refer to policy owners, and it says, and specifically highlights that the policy owner, the persons designated pursuant to subdivision A. So what it's pointing out here is that policy, that in order for subdivision C to be given effect, and for the other policy, the other subsections to be given effect, the designation right pursuant to subdivision A has to be applied across the board, and it applies to the policy owner. And that language in subsection B would give a right on January 1st, 2013 to pre-2013 policy years. And one final note, I'll just say that this case is extraordinarily important in terms of its a potential effect on what the rights are of millions of really seniors who are the beneficiaries to these life insurance policies. How these statutes need to be interpreted is a question of, frankly, humongous importance. And although my friend is making the point that the number of claims is going to decrease with time, in fact, these policies are coming up for, they're making claims now. And a lot of these policy beneficiaries don't even know they have claims.
All right, counsel, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court.